welcome to the show. This is a live Saturday afternoon edition. This has been Lancaster filling in for the one and only Roger Metz. I was thinking of calling him maybe like our fearless leader. Roger, if you're listening, thank you for giving me the opportunity to sit in your absence. Roger and his daughter Taylor are down in Myrtle Beach. Taylor and her archery team, the Upstate Hurricanes, qualified in Kentucky in early May for the National Archery in Schools World Tournament. So congratulations just for making it there. And Taylor, we're cheering you on from here and look forward to getting a text or a call from Roger saying it all went well and maybe you guys end up winning the whole thing. So good work so far. I don't know about you guys, but it is hot outside. I was doing a little yard work this morning. I live down in Columbia and was doing a little yard work and it just didn't feel much like deer season. However, many of us are already getting ready for deer season, maybe doing food plots or hanging tree stands or clearing shooting lanes. And so for some of us, deer season is sort of already upon us, certainly not the hunting part of it, but getting ready. And so I'm really excited. We're going to have Adam Keith of Growing Deer TV with us today. Many of you may be familiar with Dr. Grant Woods. That's his live video that he puts out every week. And Adam is his co-host, and he's been gracious enough to join us later in the show. And we're going to talk about deer habitat. We're going to talk about management. We're going to talk about what it takes to be successful in the season, but talk about a little bit about what it takes to be successful in preparation for the season. So Adam will join us there to talk about that. I'm also thrilled. We have Colonel Craig Boddington that will be joining in a little later on, and we're going to talk about the North American model of wildlife conservation. And why is that important? Well, I think it's important because as hunters, as outdoorsmen and women, as fishermen and fisherwomen, we have a responsibility to be able to explain to people why it is we do what we do and be able to justify it. And so we're going to go through the North American model. We're going to talk about all the principles that are aligned there. And Colonel Craig Boddington has written many books and many articles related to the topic. And so he'll bring a wealth of knowledge to the table that we'll all stand to benefit from. As always, you can tune in live on 94.5.com. Click on the Listen Live button. There's a free app on your phone where you can listen to it from anywhere you are. If you would, take a moment to like us on Facebook with Woods and Water South Carolina Radio. Follow us on Instagram at hashtag Woods and Water South Carolina Radio. Roger does a great job of putting the podcast up on woodsandwatersc.com every week. So you're welcome to tune in after the fact, or you want to go back and listen to some things that were discussed on the show. Woodsandwatersouthcarolina.com is a great place to do that, to get those podcasts. And as always, if you'd like to be part of the show, you can do so. Dial in to 864-235-9405. There are some, with the 4th of July holiday just right around the corner, there's some really fantastic events and things that are coming up that you and your family may want to take part of. So I want to let you know about some of those. Here in the Greer area tonight, June 25th from 6 to 10:30, they're going to do the Greer Freedom Blast. And there'll be all sorts of fun things you can do. That kicks off at 6 o'clock. They're going to do a blood drive. They're going to have a kids zone, inflatables, live music. They're going to have a rib eating contest. They're going to do a military tribute at 8:30, which is fantastic. They're going to have food booths, all sorts of concessions, lots of fun things for the family that you can take part in tonight. There's going to be a 4th of July celebration that's going to take place at Caesar's Head State Park. It's just going to be a perfect venue to be able to see the fireworks and be able to get a unique perspective because you'll be above them. $10 for adults, $5 for children. The Clemson Fest 2016, headed up by the Clemson Area Chamber of Commerce, will kick off at 5 p.m., runs to 10. Fireworks start at 9:30, and the Carolina Coast Band will be playing live there, so make sure you check that out. If you're one of the first 1,000 people in attendance, you'll get a flag, American flag, donated by the Tri-County Ace Hardware, the Ace Hardware that I went to as a student all the time. Barbecue, grilled chicken, and lots of fun things to take part of there. Much more that we'll talk about. Stay tuned. We'll have Colonel Craig Boddington coming right up. South Carolina. Welcome back. I am excited about this next segment and the next gentleman that's going to join us. Colonel Craig Boddington, on a very last minute request, has decided to join us. Mr. Boddington, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Ben. Please make it Craig, Ben. Well, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Thank you. You told me that on the phone yesterday, but I didn't want to do it again without your permission, so I'll refer to you. I'll refer to you as Craig. So you're certainly deserving of being called Colonel. But if you don't mind, can I give the audience a little bit of history, some biography on you?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure.
So Craig attended the University of Kansas on an NROTC scholarship, retired from the United States Marine Corps Reserves in 2005 with rank of colonel. After service in both the Gulf War in 91 and the Persian Gulf in 2002 to 2003. He joined Peterson's Publishing Company in 1979 and was editor of Peterson's Hunting Magazine from 1983 to 94. He is executive field editor for Intermedia Outdoor Group, including Guns and Ammo, Peterson's Hunting, Peterson's Rifle Shooter Magazine, and co-host of Guns and Ammo TV and Peterson's Hunting Adventures TV. He and his daughter, Brittany, also hosts the Boddington Experience TV on the Sportsman's Channel. And just to push it a little further, he's published 4,000 magazine articles, authored 25 books on hunting, shooting, and conservation, and has appeared in more than 500 television episodes. So long introduction, but certainly deserved.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Yep. That's enough.
That's enough. So I was Roger Metz is the gentleman. This is his show, and I fill in for him from time to time. And when I started thinking about what I thought would be beneficial to the audience, I thought about the North American model. When I was at the Dallas Safari Club several months ago, I had the pleasure of meeting you there and picked up one of your books, Hunting, What Youth Need to Know. And I read through it. And the reason I chose that book is from time to time, we'll take children, normally children of fallen soldiers, hunting. And I thought, I want to arm myself with information that I can pass on to them. And so what I'm hopeful we can do here, we've got until about 3:30 to be able to talk through the North American model and go through the basic principles, talk about the seven sisters of conservation, and just get your insight, maybe put some arrows in the quiver for the audience here so they can better explain why we do what we do and be more intelligent about that. So if you don't mind, we'll kind of dive right in.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben. You know, first of all, I think it's really important that we understand how we got to where we are today, mm-hmm. because you know, you guys are fortunate there in South Carolina. You've got the longest deer season in the country that I know of, and,
right.
and certainly the most liberal bag limit. And, mm-hmm. and across the, you know, just in North America, there's 35 million white-tailed deer today. But it wasn't always that way. I mean, I'm from the state of Kansas, and deer were declared extinct in Kansas in 1925, mm-hmm. Meaning not a single one. They started to filter back in World War II. But if you go back a little further, by 1900, all of our big game populations were in terrible shape. We really ravaged this continent during our pioneering and our settlement era. And it was in 1888, Theodore Roosevelt and some buddies founded the Boone and Crockett Club, which was really the first conservation organization, and really like most genuine conservation organizations, definitely hunter-based.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Theodore Roosevelt went on to bigger and better things.
Right.
And it was his concept that the way it works and the way it does work on this continent is that hunters and fishermen pay for wildlife conservation and fisheries conservation, not only in this country, but the Canadians very much follow our model, or mm-hmm. we follow theirs, so they'd probably argue that. But Mexico is running a little behind,
sure.
but they're actually catching up very fast. So the way conservation is done on this continent today is what we call the North American model. And the way we do it is different than the way it's done everywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, there is no difference. Everywhere else in the world, in any country that has viable wildlife, it's really the hunters that foot the bill for management. But it's done in such different ways. And the North American model, at least according to the Wildlife Society, which is a professional group of wildlife biologists, and by the way, I'm just a layman. I am not a wildlife biologist. I'm a lifelong hunter. But I believe in conservation, and I believe that hunters are the greatest conservationists. But the Wildlife Society proposes that there are seven principles or linchpins or tenets to the North American model, and this really defines the way we do things on this continent. And they're all important. The first one is that in North America, wildlife is considered a public trust resource. And that means that all of us own the wildlife equally. We own it. It's not privatized. If you have private land, and I've got a little farm in Kansas, I take care of the deer, but they're not my deer. They're still a public trust resource. Now, obviously, landowners have the choice as to whether they can harvest game or not harvest game, and who they can allow onto their property to help with that chore. That's part of landowner rights. But still, the wildlife on private land is also a public trust resource. And of course, in this country, we've got lots and lots of public land. The second tenet is elimination of markets. Now, we saw what happened to the bison in the 1860s and 70s. They were wiped out by market hunters, and the same thing happened with waterfowl populations in the 20s. So we don't sell wildlife in this country, and the best example of that is if you see venison or wild boar or something on a menu in a restaurant, that was farm raised. It is not wild, because it's illegal to sell game meat in this country. The third tenet is that wildlife is allocated by law. The harvests and the seasons are set by law, and of course they're increasingly complex. In most cases, that's delegated to the states. So each state has a natural resource department or a game department or a fish and wildlife department, and they're the ones who propose the legislation that creates the seasons and sets the license fees, but wildlife is allocated by law. The fourth tenet is we believe that wildlife can only be harvested for legitimate purposes. Now, legitimate purposes is a spongy term. Obviously, for food is one, but when you're talking about predators, then you're talking about essential management. You're talking about overpopulation. You're again talking about essential management, but there has to be a legitimate purpose. The fifth tenet, which is really, really, really important, is that on this continent, we believe that science is the tool. We only set seasons and harvest wildlife when qualified biologists figure out what we've got and what we can spare and what is a sustainable harvest. The sixth one is a little confusing to a lot of folks. We believe that wildlife is an international resource. Now, this has its basis in early migratory bird treaties with Canada, and was followed with migratory bird treaties with Mexico. But we believe that wildlife is actually belongs to all people in all places. And, you know, sometimes I'm not really happy with decisions U.S. Fish and Wildlife has made, especially recently, regarding importation of elephant ivory and importation of lion trophies. But realistically, it is one of our beliefs that wildlife is an international resource. So that gives us essentially the moral ground to be involved in wildlife around the world, not just here at home. And the last one is of equal importance to all, and that's that we believe in the democracy of hunting. And you could extend that, the democracy of hunting and fishing. And now, in the only country in the world that I'm aware of that guarantees hunting as a right is the country in their constitution, is the country of Botswana in southern Africa. Yeah, that's in their constitution, but it's certainly not in ours. So hunting is not a guaranteed right. It's a privilege. But we believe in the democracy of hunting, in that any citizen in good standing has the ability to hunt and fish if he or she wishes to, and certainly not to if he or she wishes not to. Mm-hmm. And we're one of the very, very few countries in the world where, and Canada also, where we have basically free access to millions and millions and millions of acres of public land that's available for hunting and fishing. I mean, obviously, it's allocated by law, so that's within the season, and you have to have a license, but it's out there. And, of course, how available that is depends on your good fortune in where you live. There's less public land in the east than there is in the west, but there is public land available there in South Carolina, quite
sure.
a bit of it.
Yes, there is.
The state of Montana has more than 30 million acres mm-hmm. of public land, mm-hmm. lots. We don't have very much in Kansas. I'm in Kansas today and headed down to the farm later.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have much in Kansas, but Kansas has invested heavily in both leases and ground that they own. And there's so you see little yellow signs all over the state that say public hunting area. Beautiful sign.
That's, sure, sure. Yeah, South Carolina, we have quite a bit of public land. And it's nice that we do because not everyone.
Yes, you do. I've looked it up.
Yeah, not everyone can afford to own property or not everyone can afford to be a member of a hunting lease. And so the public lands give you a great opportunity to get out there, whether you like to hunt or just simply observe nature. So, it's a really great resource. Absolutely right.
Well, and like I said, the seven tenets that I gave you are the ones that are proposed by the Wildlife Society of outdoor professionals.
Mm-hmm.
But these aren't written in stone. You can combine a couple and you can add another. And if you, are ever curious, go on the Arizona Game and Fish Department
mm-hmm.
website,
right.
And they combine two, and they add another one. And the one that they add is as a tenet of the way we do things in North America is that hunters and fishermen pay for wildlife and fisheries conservation. They just say it flat out.
Sure.
I think it's kind of implied in all of these, but they say it straight out. And then if you read a little bit further, they go on and ask the question, well, what if hunting and fishing were stopped in this country like some of the antis would like to do? And that's a real easy forward answer, and this is probably the best piece of ammunition that we have to use against anti-hunters and in reasoning with non-hunters who don't understand. And those four words are, there is no alternative funding.
Sure.
You know, if we stop paying our license fees and if we stop buying firearms and ammunition and paying the built-in excise tax mm-hmm. that goes straight to wildlife mm-hmm. management, there is no alternative funding. There is no other way known on this continent at this time for paying for wildlife management. So we as hunters and fishermen, we foot the bill. And we foot the bill not only for ourselves so that we can enjoy the woods and waters, but also so that hikers, bikers, campers, photographers, nature lovers, nature Nazis, tree huggers, fern fairies, everyone can enjoy equally.
Right.
But we're the ones that foot the bill, and that's so important.
Well, and much of that had to do with sportsmen realizing the issue at hand and then taking action. I think it was in 1937 when the sportsmen actually lobbied Congress to pass the Pittman-Robertson Wildlife Act, Restoration
That's
Act.
Correct.
And so, and then
That's
it,
correct.
That carried it further to not just the sporting equipment and ammunition, but to fishing equipment. Is it the
That's
Dingle
right.
Johnson Act? And so that was in 1950. So sportsmen, not only do they support what it is that they do, but we actually are self-limiting in a way where we realize that we want to continue to be able to, let's say, deer hunt or turkey hunt or waterfowl hunt. And we will put self-imposed restrictions on ourselves to limit bag harvest or seasons to make it something sustainable long-term.
Absolutely. We're probably the most self-limiting body in the entire world because
right.
virtually all of our restrictions, our bag limits, our seasons and all of that, they're proposed by hunters.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. What do you think it is that, how can we better get that message across to people who, again, the antis, as we call them, are there, they are as, staunch in their views about why we shouldn't be able to hunt as we are in our right to hunt or just even enjoy the outdoors, whether it's hunting or fishing or just bird watching or photography. What's the best way we can demonstrate this positive message? Obviously, going through the seven tenets may be a little exhaustive for someone, but what's your recommendation when we come across people just in general conversation, maybe people in our family or just friends that we may encounter?
I think it's really difficult to convince genuine anti-hunters. They've already made up their mind. Mm. But fortunately, they're in the minority. They're probably a smaller minority than we are. The recent survey is that hunting is widely accepted by the majority of the American people, provided that it's for a legitimate purpose,
sure,
food management, et cetera. But I just think we have to be very, very rational in our approach and folks, try to get some facts in there. You know, the fact is that we fund wildlife management, and through the Pittman-Robertson funding, we've funded wildlife management to the tune of billions in this country. The anti-hunters aren't funding that.
Sure. In addition to the licensing fees, the regulations that we succumb to, the wildlife funding through the Pittman-Robertson Act, and we haven't talked about the Lacey Act, which is sort of restrictive in a way as well. But then you have a whole host of conservation groups who have stepped up to meet the challenge. Boone and Crockett, obviously the first, but there's a whole host of other groups. What's the significance of those groups in terms of what they're able to do to push conservation forward?
Well, they're tremendously important, and most of them are hunter-based. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Wild Sheep Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever. Some of them that I've just named are special purpose. And then you have broad-based organizations like Safari Club International and Dallas Safari Club that really have a broader and more general agenda. But, you know, we as hunters give well over $100 million a year to these organizations. And so, you know, you'd call them NGOs, non-governmental organizations.
I hate to cut you off. We are so close to the end, Mr. Boddington. If someone wants to learn more about this topic, what's the best way to do that?
Get on the internet and Google the North American model. There's some great stuff there, and probably the best source is the National Shooting Sports Foundation, NSSF.
Thank you so much, sir.
National Shooting Sports Foundation.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
And you. Thank you very much.
I think my head is still spinning. That was a lot of information, and I wish we'd had more time to continue with Mr. Boddington, but I'm so grateful. Literally, I called him on Wednesday of this week after reading his book and just digging deeper into conservation and the North American model. I was going to do my best to describe it, and I said, you know what? I'm just going to reach out to him, and he was gracious enough to join us in that. On a last minute request, I have Adam Keith with Growing Deer TV with us. Adam, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing good. Listen, thank you so much for joining us. You, just like Craig, is a last minute request, and both you guys stepped up, and I appreciate that.
Hey, I appreciate you having me.
Sure. I would assume much of the audience here in South Carolina is probably familiar with Growing Deer. If they're not necessarily familiar with Growing Deer, they're probably familiar with Dr. Grant Woods. Obviously, Grant was so integral with QDMA and still is Quality Deer Management Association, and being a Clemson grad, my alma mater, which I'm extremely proud of. And so Grant is well known in this area, and you assist Grant very heavily with the show. If I'm not mistaken, you serve as a co-host and you do a lot of the video editing. You do a lot of the grunt work probably too, hanging deer stands and cutting shooting lanes. Would you kind of speak to all the things that you might do for the Growing Deer show, Adam?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. So I've been with Growing Deer and Grant 5 years now, and I kind of cover a lot of the field production side. Luckily for me and my schedule, I don't handle a lot of the editing for the actual show. I do more of the editing for some of the clips page and YouTube unboxing videos. Like, we may get a new bow in. Just last week I edited that. That's kind of the editing that I do, but a lot of the field production, so I'm filming the segments for the show every week. And then a lot of the field work. I'm kind of organizing that. I have Daniel and Matt that assist me in those projects, but sure. I help get all that organized and hanging tree stands. So like last week we were starting to trim out sets. So just kind of a lot of different stuff, basically.
Yeah. You got the gar hole all figured out?
I got the gar hole all figured out.
Good.
Yep.
I'll see you guys soon.
So you can come up in November and I'll have it ready for you.
Yep. Thank you. I appreciate that. Matt, so I reached out to Grant. You know, the company I work for, Outdoor Underwriters, and Grant, we have a really good relationship there. And I'd reached out to Grant about some of the field producer, field staff roles. And so a good friend of mine, he and I submitted in, and Matt actually emailed us yesterday, and they let us join the team. So we're really excited about that. So we'll see what we can contribute, if anything. So,
well, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, you guys will accept
messages, right? Anybody listening can join. Absolutely. Anybody that's listening right now can join the field staff portion of Growing Deer. It's just a great way for us to get some content, social media posts. Some of the guys edit short clips for our YouTube page or social media pages. So just a way for people to become part of the Growing Deer team.
The Growing Deer model, the show, everything about it is unique. There's nothing else like it that I'm aware of. And I think that's why you guys have had the unbelievable success that you've had, right? You're going to get an action-packed show. It always is. There's always something. I mean, something's going to probably be harvested, right? That's going to happen, whether it's a deer or soybeans or whatever it is. Something's getting harvested. And you guys are going to also talk about the science behind it. And then Grant never fails to bring his faith into the show, which I'm always appreciative of.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic show. Can you kind of discuss, and to the extent that you have the knowledge of it, Grant's expertise leading up to be able to create Growing Deer, and why his platform of Growing Deer has been so successful?
Okay. Well, so Grant has been incorporated for 25 years as a wildlife consultant. So he's traveled around and met on these properties and done all sorts of management practices. And then as he had children and was traveling so much, he looked for a way to basically stay home more. And so instead of getting hired to go travel to these properties, he decided to start a show to where basically he was just giving the information away for free with hopes that sponsors or companies would want to be associated with that. So but the model is every week we have some sort of segment to educate landowners and hunters to where they can be a better landowner, wildlife management, and ultimately a better hunter.
Better hunter. Well, kind of speaking about that in terms of, you know, in South Carolina, in the lower part of the state, our deer season opens August 15th. I don't know if you knew that our season
opened.
Yep, August 15th. And so for a lot of guys, and much like you already, there's work being done. There's food plots being prepped. There's seed getting put in the ground, shooting lanes getting cut, tree stands being hung, all that sort of thing. You guys doing the same thing at the Proving Grounds currently?
Absolutely. It basically never stops. We always talk about getting ready for deer season, but I don't think we ever stop getting ready for deer season. As soon as the season ends, it's like, okay, let's look at our inventory on Reconyx. Let's see what bucks are left and who we're going to be hunting next year. So it's a year-round process.
When does your season end up there?
It ends January 15th.
January 15th. So as soon as the season's over, you're pulling cards. You're checking to see what bucks made it through the winter, I guess, and you're starting to formulate your hit list or whatever you want to call it, what bucks you'll have next year, and then immediately you're planning, I guess, turkey season and then into preparing for deer season, right?
Yeah, with planting food plots, and that's another thing we do a lot during the January, February months is we're looking over our food plots to see what's left over, if there's much left over. If there's nothing left over, we know we need to shoot more does the next year. So that's kind of where we're at right now. We're looking at food plots. This summer headed into a drought, and we're like, we have a lot more deer than we can hold right now because of the lack of food. So we're going to be shooting a lot of does this fall.
Speaking of, you said drought. On your show now, you guys have been using the Genesis no-till drill. I've noticed that often. Is that a technique that can be utilized effectively in drought situations?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you're planting – it's best not to disc or plow the soil to conserve the soil moisture. So if you are going to plant in areas where you're going to get a drought, most likely, like here in the Proving Grounds, you definitely need to utilize everything you have, especially the soil moisture. So no-tilling is the best practice for that. Basically.
For that, sure. Do you find that, I guess you guys get a lot better, I don't know what you want to call it, germination from these seeds instead of doing a broadcast or disking in from the no-till drill?
Absolutely.
Is it even comparable?
Yeah. Absolutely. I actually started planting food plots when I was 12 at my family farm, and we didn't know any better, so we were plowing and disking and harrowing, doing anything because we thought you had to get better seed-to-soil contact, and that was the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would basically chance it, okay, there's 50% chance of rain the next couple of days, let's plow our food plots. And then we wouldn't get that rain, and that soil would just sit there, and the moisture was gone. It was just powder. And then when it finally did rain, the soil had crusted over, and it was like, so we didn't get that great of stands early on.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, I almost scratched my head, and I say, I can't believe I actually did that for so many years. Now with the no-till drill, basically the seed, you're getting perfect seed-to-soil contact, and then if there's already moisture in the soil, most of the time those seeds are going to germinate even with just the moisture in the soil before, and you're not even waiting on the rain. So when you get a rain, it's another additive, and it ultimately increases your food plot production.
How about cover crops? Can you speak to that in terms of utilizing the no-till drill or just any? Some guys may not have access to that piece of equipment, right? There's co-ops here.
Absolutely.
Can you speak to you utilizing a cover crop to sort of help your food plot production?
Okay, so basically farmers in crop areas call it cover crops, while food plot guys just call them fall food plots. Basically kind of the same concept. It's usually what we like is a mix. We use the Eagle Seed Broadside, which has turnips, radishes, wheat, and soybeans in it. And so that is a food plot for us, but in crop country, same thing, cover crop. And basically those plants, that food plot, is mining nutrients throughout the fall. And instead of having just bare ground through the winter and erosion and all your micronutrients is leaving the soil, you've got the cover crop there that's feeding the deer and also increasing the health of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about those, kind of the brassicas especially, is they're a very small seed. So you can just broadcast them on the ground and get pretty good germination just without a drill, without a disc, with basically just broadcasting on the ground.
And the idea is that it's helping what retain moisture and block and give some shade while the new seeds are in their early stages.
And then we fast forward into the spring, and it's kept that soil moisture.
Mm-hmm.
It's pulled nutrients deep from the soil up to the surface and into the plant. And then as we kill that cover crop off in April or May, it starts to release those nutrients back in the soil as the soybeans have just been planted. So those nutrients are just right there for those young soybeans to take back up.
That's perfect, right? So
perfect.
Adam, we're going to have a break coming up in about another minute or two, but I'm hopeful you can stay through the break with us because I want to get into some things related to how we might want to hang tree stands, just kind of some hunting tactics and things that we can do throughout the summer. And then if you will, maybe give some tips on camera work, how guys maybe in a two-man set can configure things and think about. And this kind of get a little bit deeper into hunting strategies as we go through here into the break, if you'll stick with us here in the next
Absolutely.
Little bit. Good deal. So we're so grateful that Adam has been with us now. He's going to stay through the break, and we're going to talk about what it's going to take to be more successful this coming fall. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. This has been a fantastic show. Lots of information. It's going really quickly. And I'm just thankful that, Adam, you stayed through the break so we can kind of continue our conversation. We've got what I was hoping to dive into a little bit is, and I sort of ran by this too quickly, the place that Grant owns is called the Proving Grounds. And I think it'd probably be helpful for the group here, the audience, to understand what the Proving Grounds actually is and why it was named what it was named.
Okay. So the Proving Grounds is a piece of land just northwest of Branson, Missouri. It's 2,200 acres, and it is some of the roughest stuff in Missouri for sure, maybe parts of the country as far as whitetail management goes. Very rocky, a lot of elevation changes. And you often, when I was growing up and I watched a lot of shows, they always heard them talk about the thermals out west when you're elk hunting. Mm-hmm. Of course, I never really understood what they were talking about because my family farm's not that big of an elevation change. Mm-hmm. So when I started hunting Grant, it's like thermals shifting, and there's so much more that goes into just planning a hunt, let alone deer management, because it's so rough, so rocky. He's never used a disc there because of soil management, but also you would just break disc because it's so rocky. Mm. And as an example, one of the ridge top food plots that I was on several years ago running a drill across the top, it was just before dark, and I looked behind me, and every little culver had sparks coming off of it because it was so rocky.
Is that right? Yeah.
So a lot of flint, just very rocky. So we call it the proving grounds because we think that if a management practice can be used here, it can be used almost anywhere.
Sure. And you guys have taken this model. I think there's a track in Kentucky, right? The Proving Grounds, maybe some other ground. And that's a similar model that I think that they've incorporated Grant's wildlife management practices on their property. Again, with the same idea that if it can be done here, it can be done anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Good friend Terry Hamby owns that piece.
I know Terry. Yep.
And it's a little bit different, a lot flatter, lot better deer hunting, just easier. There's not many thermal shifts and stuff like that. So, another great farm.
Maybe that's why Andrew's been so successful. You said it's a little bit easier out there, right?
Yeah, it is a little bit easier. That's why we go over there. When you get tired of banging our head against the wall at the Proving Grounds with shifting winds and everything, that we just go to Kentucky.
Absolutely. Andrew's a good friend of mine. I see him at a lot of QDMA conventions, so we always get to chat a little bit. And I got to meet Terry this past year at the QDMA convention, which was really nice. Kind of just a talk shop, you know, just to talk about hunting and all. So our audience from where we are, a great majority of South Carolina can kind of hear us at the moment. So you've got guys that are going to bow hunt and guys that are going to rifle hunt. And you know, young kids are going to be out there for the first time. And so we want their success of field, or we want their opportunity when they go in the field to be as successful as possible. Throw us some tips and techniques that you guys do. Maybe it's scent control. Maybe it's just planning for the hunt. Just kind of talk about the strategies that you and the Growing Deer team use to be successful year after year.
Okay. Well, every hunt obviously starts out for us with scent control. All our clothes are washed in dead downwind products, and we look before the – so clothes are all treated. Now it's time to plan for the hunt. Of course, we're checking the wind, but we also have to consider the thermals, like I mentioned earlier, and – planning for that, a lot of times we don't even hunt if the wind's less than 5 miles an hour. I know when I was growing up in college, whatever, if I had a chance to hunt, I went, conditions were horrible. And in the last couple of years, Grant and I have gotten really serious about, and maybe it's because I got married and I had to make time outside of hunting. So everybody knows how that is. Absolutely. Changes a little bit.
Yes,
but when the conditions aren't favorable, like 3-mile-an-hour wind, high humidity, stuff like that, we don't even hunt. And we call it family time because you're almost doing more harm than good. And last year, so for some reason, the way it lined out, all our cold fronts hit like Friday, Saturday, Sunday last year.
There you go.
So we would hunt Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoon. And then during the week, we hardly hunted because the conditions weren't favorable. And we had really good success last year and years prior just on this system of not hunting when the conditions aren't favorable. And I know it's strange for a lot of people to think about that. Well, it's a weekend, I'm going hunting, but you almost do more harm than good if you're hunting in those unfavorable conditions.
Save up your vacation days, take them when the opportunity is right, I guess is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Got it.
Absolutely.
So a lot of guys, you know, myself included, really big into archery now. That's what we've done for many years. So from a bow hunting perspective, kind of give your thoughts about how you'll pick stand placement, how you might strategize a little bit about, you know, a mature buck that you're going to try to harvest, or setting up maybe when you think about a food plot or a hardwood bottom or something along those lines, kind of just your strategy and stand placement, what you're thinking about there.
Okay. A lot of variables coming into play, but we always talk about the limiting factor, food, cover, water, and also security. But if it's a drought, we're going to try and find water holes. If it's a lack of food, or acorns are the limited factor, or that's what the food source is, we're basing our hunts around acorns, not just the acorn trees, but the transition areas from bedding to those acorn places.
Mm-hmm.
And for us in timber country, which South Carolina, you're probably dealing with the same stuff as us, you're basically we're trying to find those bottlenecks, pinch points in between the bedding areas and the food source, if that's acorns or whatever that is. And for us, since we have 400-foot elevation change, we're really looking around saddles and ridges, shelves on the side of ridges, mm-hmm. stuff like that to really bottleneck the deer down and basically try and harvest them there. Another one is as the rut starts going or chase phase starts happening at late October, then we start really kind of shifting around more, I guess, closer to the bedding areas
mm-hmm.
because we know those bucks are going to be looking for receptive does, so we're really starting to hunt more around the bedding areas, and then as the ruts really starts kicking off, the does are going to those bedding areas basically to try and hide from the bucks.
Right.
So we go from hunting food sources early on to hunting more around cover and bedding areas as the season or as a rut starts to start to kick up.
Starts to kick up. You guys,
yeah.
You guys pretty well bow hunt year round, do you not? Or is your state a little different in terms of when you're allowed to use certain weapons?
So in Missouri, we kick off September 15th for archery,
mm-hmm.
and it runs all the way to basically the second week of November for rifle season. So I think last year was November 14th, and it's usually 10 days. And so it's like November 14th to November 24th,
mm-hmm.
and that's just rifle hunting only. And then right as soon as it ends, November 25th, archery season kicks back,
okay.
and it's archery season all the way to January 15th, and then there's a muzzleloader season in December at some point.
Gotcha.
And it's another 10 days. So
another 10 days.
That's how Missouri's set up.
South Carolina's not all that different. September 15th here in this zone is when archery season kicks in, and I haven't looked at the regs this year to see when the exact date for big gun, as they call it, or rifle season comes in, normally mid-October, and then it's whatever you want almost the rest of the year with a little bit of primitive weapon in between. Yeah. So if you're going to have, you know, a lot of success is had early here in South Carolina with these bachelor groups. It's so early in August or early September, and a lot of just your food sources, persimmons are really popular here. Obviously, the deer just flood right to it. Beans or whatever you've got going on, the deer will push them pretty hard. So early season is great because, you know, come October 15th, there's a lot of rifles going off. And those bucks.
The Orange Army comes out.
Yeah, boy. And, those big deer are, they just don't show up anymore.
Very nocturnal.
Very nocturnal. And so that's what I've noticed in South Carolina. But I think it's great that we've got guys that, you know, hey, I just want a rifle hunter. Hey, I just want a bow hunt. I think it's great. We have so many choices. I have found that a lot of the success that we've had on our little farm has been early season. It's been before the rifles start going off. And it's finding those bachelor groups and getting some of that summer trend coming through. What are these deer doing? Getting our stands where we need them to seize on that opportunity. So I'm sure you guys do a lot of the same.
That brings up an interesting point. Is if you're hunting areas with high hunting pressure, gun season's going on, you have a lot of neighbors, that's when sanctuaries become a huge factor in continuing success throughout the season. That's what I've done. My family farm's just under 300 acres, and I have a lot of neighbors that gun hunt around me.
Mm-hmm.
And so when gun season hits, I really try and stay out of certain areas, basically to serve as a sanctuary so the deer can go there, feel safe, and they're not getting shot at by everybody. And
that's
really helped me out.
I saw Grant on a video one time. He was talking about sanctuaries, but he was talking about food plots within sanctuaries that do not get hunted, but maybe once a year. And so so within that sanctuary, not just cover, but there's food, as you indicated, and water and whatever may need to be there. But, and then go into that one time, maybe it's the most optimal time, wind's perfect, weather conditions are perfect, the rut's in full swing, whatever it is. And then that's where a lot of success is had with you and your team.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It goes into those limited factors. You can have cover, but sometimes that cover doesn't have security because neighbor's dog or neighbors sneaking through it. If there's security and cover, then you have a ideal sanctuary.
Got it. Adam, I have kept you longer than I told you I would, but you have been really insightful, and I greatly appreciate your time. If the guys want to learn more about growing deer, learn more about you, where do you recommend they go?
growingdeer.com, or you can check us out on Facebook at Grant Woods, or on Instagram at Growing Deer, Twitter, Growing Deer, any of our social media handles there. You can find out, find more about us, and hopefully learn some more information.
If we can't find you, it's our fault, right? You're everywhere.
Yeah, there you go.
Good.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great weekend.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben.
Talk
Take
with you
care.
Soon. Take care. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed the segment today. We've had two unbelievable callers on who have given us so much information. I think we now maybe understand a little better why we have the privilege of hunting. Some of the tenets that Colonel Craig Boddington talked about, some information that we can better arm ourselves with when we're talking to friends or family or maybe even people who are against hunting. We've got some tools at our disposal that we can say, hey, here's what hunters have done. Here's the thought process and the way that we self-regulate the sport that we love. And then Adam just did a fantastic job in sharing ideas and tactics and techniques on how to be more successful in the woods. And I just always want to thank Dr. Grant Woods for the way that he unashamedly shares his faith and enjoying creation. And it's just such a wonderful show. I encourage you to go see it. This has been a lot of fun. As Roger always says, make time to get out there. Take the back roads when you can. And don't forget the camera. Stay tuned because Roger will be back next week with a fresh new show. Have a great weekend.
Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't you just like a friend of mine? To hit me from behind. Yes, I'm